You're listening to Write the Book, the podcast for writers and curious readers, coming to you from Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with the author Eowyn Ivey, whose debut novel, The Snow Child, was a finalist for the Pulitzer, a UK National Book Award winner, and a New York Times bestseller. It is published in more than 25 languages and 30 countries. Her new novel is To the Bright Edge of the World, published by Little Brown. Here's a short introduction. In the winter of 1885, decorated war hero Colonel Allen Forrester leads a small band of men on an expedition that has been deemed impossible to venture up the Wolverine River and pierce the vast, untamed Alaska Territory. Leaving behind Sophie, his newly pregnant wife, Colonel Forrester records his extraordinary experiences in hopes that his journal will reach her if he doesn't return. Once he passes beyond the edge of the known world, there's no telling what awaits him. The Wolverine River Valley is not only breathtaking and forbidding, but also terrifying in ways that the colonel and his men never could have imagined. As they map the territory and gather information on the native tribes, whose understanding of the natural world is unlike anything they have ever encountered, Forrester and his men discover the blurred lines between human and wild animal, the living and the dead. And while the men knew they would face starvation and danger, they cannot escape the sense that some greater mysterious force threatens their lives. Meanwhile, on her own at Vancouver Barracks, Sophie chafes under the social restrictions and yearns to travel alongside her husband. She does not know that the winter will require as much of her as it does of her husband, that both her courage and faith will be tested to the breaking point. Can her exploration of nature through the new art of photography help her to rediscover her sense of beauty and wonder? The truths that Allen and Sophie discover over the course of that fateful year change both of their lives and the lives of those who hear their stories long after they're gone, forever. When I spoke with Eowyn Ivey, I asked her to begin by talking about Alaska as inspiration, as story element, and as home.
Well, I grew up in Alaska, and my husband and daughters and I live about 70 miles northeast of Anchorage, and both my husband and I grew up in this area. Mm-hmm. And I think I write about it because it's the place that I know and that I love, and that also that I'm trying to kind of grasp in some way. I think all places are complex, but for me, Alaska, I have a lot of mixed feelings about it, so I think through my fiction I'm trying to kind of understand my own feelings about the place better.
Okay. And as a story element, I found it just fascinating. I think maybe because it is still such a wild place, and it sort of easily steps back in time. Even if you write about it in a contemporary setting, it feels like a step back in time. But I wonder, can you just talk about it as a story element?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, I guess partly what was required of me as a writer was when I left Alaska to go to college, and that was when I, because, you know, when you grow up someplace, you think every place is like where
right.
you grow up, you know,
right.
And so it was really, you know, living somewhere else for 4 years, going to college, we were down in Washington, that I kind of started to get the sense of Alaska as being a very different place. In that, in both things that you mentioned, one is that there's just a lot of wild land here still, and unlike most of the world anymore, civilization is small compared to the kind of vast wilderness around it. And then the other thing is exactly like you said, history here is so relatively new. You know, it really struck me when I was in the UK on tour for the new book that when I talk about 1885 to people in London or Edinburgh, you know, it's like
right.
that's just a blip in their history. But in terms of documented kind of Western civilization history in Alaska, that's almost as far as we go back, you know. So it is kind of a different understanding of history and place, I think. But I think it took me kind of stepping outside of it and seeing it from an outsider's perspective to really understand that maybe this could be an interesting element of a story.
Right. It's funny thinking about that. Like, if you were in London talking about the time period, you were probably sitting in a building that preceded that time period.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you think about, you know, stories like Sherlock Holmes and all these stories that were coming out of England at that time. And here it was just a completely kind of unmapped territory still in a lot of ways. So, yeah, it is kind of crazy to think about the difference in history.
Yeah. Now, you did open the book with a map of Alaska. It's
So first of all, I should just mention that I was reading an advanced reader's copy on a Kindle, so I'm not 100% sure what it all looks like in the print version of the book, but it seemed to me maybe that the map was the first of your actual art pieces that show up in the book, or drawings or photographs, and that it was part of a piece for that and not just so that there would be a map of place. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? There's a couple elements of the map about how it kind of came to be. One was that when I wrote The Snow Child, you know, I set it on this fictional Wolverine River. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really think about it much because I figured, well, it's fiction. I can do whatever I want. But then I had book clubs, you know, contacting me and saying, you know, we discussed your book and we're trying to look up the Wolverine River on an atlas and we can't find it anywhere. And I was like, oh, shoot, I guess I didn't really think about people wanting to, like, place it within a real Alaska.
Right.
And so part of, you know, coming back to the Wolverine River in the new book, I realized I wanted to have a map in part so people could have sort of a sense of where this fictional river would be, you know, within South Central Alaska. But then also, I think throughout the new book, like, one of the things I was having a lot of fun with as a writer, and I wanted to hopefully do for the reader, was to make it not clear where fiction and nonfiction separated, you know, what parts of these stories are true, what are not true. And it was kind of fun because the young woman who did the map for me, and she also did some of the sketches, she worked at the bookstore here in Palmer, Alaska with me for a lot of years. And she did the map, and she said that she intentionally used a raven as sort of a compass, in part because there's some elements of it within the story, but also because it's sort of the trickster. So the idea is that, like, this map, you wouldn't want to navigate by this map. Don't trust this map because it's a trickster map. So there's lots of things in it that aren't true to the real landscape in terms of where the river goes and what the river's name is and things like that.
I love that. That's great. I didn't think about that. I did see the raven on the map, but I didn't think about him being the trickster. That's perfect.
Yeah, I really love that she did that. And that was really fun to kind of collaborate in some way with another artist. And I don't have any skills as a visual artist, so it was really fun to sort of throw ideas out to her, and then she would come back with these just amazing things. So it was really fun.
Yeah, that's great. Now, you start the book with one narrator. You do change narration, and I want to ask you about that later, but first I just wanted to talk about the opening of the book. You start with Walter Forrester, who is writing a letter announcing the fact that he has documents from his great-uncle's 1885 expedition across Alaska, letters and journals, as well as letters and other artifacts from his great-aunt Sophie's experience of her husband's absence. And the first line of his letter is, "I warned you, I am a stubborn old man." And I loved this opening. First of all, it very much engaged me, and I wanted to know who he was and why he was being stubborn. And I also liked the fact that you sort of presuppose previous communication, which kind of gets out of the way the back and forth of that first contact, where he probably first said, "Are you interested in these letters?" So I wondered how you came to this beginning.
You know, it was one of those rare cases that, and this doesn't happen to me very often. It's funny because I was talking to another Alaskan writer about this, and he had this wonderful experience where, like, the whole voice of the entire book kind of came to him in a flash, and that never really happens to me.
Yeah.
But with Walt, it really did. Like, for some reason, his voice, I think that page really was the first page that I wrote. I mean, his voice just came to me really quickly. I'm not sure why. And I appreciate what you said. I hadn't really thought about it, but I think that's something we all learn about fiction as fiction writers, that oftentimes we're tempted to start the story too soon. You know, like, we want to go back and try to lay everything out too neatly and to try to jump into the story a little more quickly. I think that's something that I've been working on and trying to learn as a fiction writer, you know, to try to engage the reader right from the beginning rather than sort of laying all the backstory down right at the beginning. So.
Right. And in that first letter, it becomes really clear what their previous communication has already been, but it does so much more sort of subtly or gracefully than if we had to read all of those previous whatever came before. Now, the other thing I loved about that first letter is that Walt says that he chooses to believe what he calls the fantastical parts of his great uncle Alan Forrester's account. And he says, this is a quote, "It takes a kind of arrogance to think everything in the world can be measured and weighed with our scientific instruments. The colonel started out with those sorts of assumptions, and as you will see, it did not serve him well." And so that was just so awesome to me, because first of all, it opens up my mind as a reader to whatever fantastical elements are about to come. And it also sets up some suspense about, well, how did it not serve him well? What's going to happen? Which we don't have to get into here, but I just wondered if you can talk about setting up suspense for the reader and helping the reader set aside skepticism and be more open-minded.
Well, you know, it's tricky because I didn't realize when I chose to tell it sort of somewhat of an epistolary novel told through letters and mm-hmm. journals and documents, I didn't realize what a challenge I was setting for myself in terms of, like, suspense is really tricky to handle in that situation because, you know, if someone's writing in their diary, obviously they've survived whatever recent thing they've been through, and, like, to create suspense in that way is much more challenging. And to be honest, one of the things that I did, and I haven't done this a lot, I mean, I feel like sometimes as I'm reading books and novels and stories, I'm sort of accumulating ideas of how to approach things. Mm-hmm. But it's rare that I actually pick up a book with that question in mind. But that's what I did. I picked up Dracula. I had read it, you know, years ago, and then I remembered that it was told in the same way through letters and journals and documents. So I was actually picking it up and looking at, like, how did he do this? How did he make the hairs on my neck stand up when it's all told in this way, you know? So I was kind of cheating and looking to see how people before me had done it. And certainly Bram Stoker does that, of sort of, you know, indicating sort of things that are going to come. I don't know, it's a really interesting trick to be able to do, and it was something I had to really focus on, to be honest. It wasn't something that just sort of came naturally.
Well, that's good to know, actually. I think I love when my conversations turn to an author's use of previous references to kind of help them deal with a problem, and I thought that, obviously, I thought this did it very well, too. But that's great to know that that's who you turn to. That's perfect.
Yeah, and it was kind of funny, too, because until it occurred to me, you know, that, of course, the Dracula was told that way, I was feeling really innovative, you know, like, ooh, I'm so good, I'm doing this, like, really cool new thing, you know, of telling letters through letters and journals, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh, wait, it has been done before, which is actually a good thing, because then I can see, how the heck did he do this, you know?
Right, exactly. You mentioned writing from letters and journals, and we've already talked about how you have different points of view, but so I wanted to just walk through what all your points of view are, and I have some questions about them. So you have Walter, and then you also have the museum representative, Joshua Sloan, who he's writing to, and they go back and forth. And then another set, and probably the main set, is Alan and his wife Sophie as they write to each other and in journals while he's on his expedition. Then you have the point of view of Pruitt, and he has a very different voice. And we know Pruitt's sections because he labels longitude and latitude at the very beginning of his sections, and also temperatures and things that have to do with photography, which is his interest, and weather. So let's just go to that. So how was it for you keeping all of this straight? As a reader, I never was confused, so I thought it was pretty impressive that you kept all this straight, and I wondered how that was for you.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that, because actually it's interesting you mentioned Pruitt. That was one section that I kind of went back and forth with my agent and my editors about how much to indicate who that was, because that is the only way I make that clear is, you know, through the longitude and latitude things. And it was hard because really what I wanted to do was hopefully make it so that the reader felt like they were discovering and, like, taking the documents out of the box and trying to figure out what is this, where does this come from, but not have too much confusion. Mm-hmm. For me, in my head, it was relatively, you know, you just spend so much time with the characters and with the, you know, so it for me, I didn't ever particularly feel confused about what I wanted to do, but maybe more how I was going to do it in a way that would work for the reader, because sometimes it's hard when you know everything in your head and how you want to do it, it's hard to know sometimes how it's being perceived on the other end. And so luckily I have a lot of readers who both, you know, people in my own community and family, but then also my agent lines up readers who I don't know who read it fresh, you know, and say, okay, I was confused about this, or I eventually figure that out and that's okay, or, you know, but it's a tricky thing to know how a reader is going to perceive it.
Yeah. Now, do you mind if I read a short section from Pruitt's voice?
Oh, no, great.
One of the things that I thought really did help me ground myself in his narration is that he has a very different voice than the other characters. So in addition to the way you opened all his sections, as soon as I was reading in Pruitt's voice, I knew it was him. So here's just a little section. What then of the six-winged seraph and cherubim with sleepless eye? No such celestials dwell here. The Midnuskis have not met our God. Their own fearsome beasts fly through these skies. Will we find them with our civilized eyes? Will they flap out of glacier crevasse and over Black River Valley while we crawl, scrabble up their mountains? First of all, just beautiful. And you know, and you kind of have to figure out what, you know, he's talking about the constellations, but at first it's like, what's he talking about? But you know, it reminded me a little bit of the character in Barbara Kingsolver's The Poisonwood Bible. She has a character that has such a unique voice. You always know that that's who's voice you're with. And this reminded me a little bit of that. So I wonder, how did you come to Pruitt's voice?
Well, I think part of it was, you know, back, you know, at the beginning when you mentioned Walt's opening letter and this idea of how we perceive the world and that we have certain tools, and when those are part of our culture, how we understand the world, we think that's the right way to perceive the world. And I guess through Pruitt, I like the idea of sort of a troubled soul and a poet. And so he's perceiving the world and coming to his interpretations through the Bible and poetry and all this. And so I kind of like the idea that it was affecting how he was understanding what was happening around him. But I did early on realize, like, I feel like, at least me, I could only take him in small doses, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's a little intense, a little depressed, and has an odd way of expressing himself. So I kept those really short and kind of spare throughout, because I didn't want to overwhelm the reader with them, because I think they are a bit much at times. So it was, but trying to add that other sense of how we try to translate the world and understand it, because you've got the colonel who's sort of this very military, linear kind of person.
Right.
And I thought it would be interesting to see the same place, the same landscape, the same people, but through this kind of more, I guess, artistic or, you know, lyrical view, I guess.
I think that's why poetry collections are so short. I mean,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
I mean, like a little bit goes
a lot of you, I think, yeah. Well, and it's interesting because my mom's a poet, actually,
yeah.
And so she's a huge inspiration to me, and we talk about that a lot. But it's true, I think a poem, and I don't consider Pruitt's entries really poems, but I hope that they, you know, touch on the poetic, at least by, you know, referencing people like Blake and things like that. But they are, they're like, you got to take them in a little dose and sort of like, okay, that's good. That's
yeah.
enough of that, I think.
Yeah. Now, how was it for you writing in the voice of the late 19th century for a contemporary reader? And how did you approach that? Did you research a lot of letters that you found in other sources? And did you update those at all? How did you go about that?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. I mean, it kind of came out naturally as I was trying to do research about really practical things, like, you know, how was photography working at the time. But then I was also reading things like there's some great books about wives of polar explorers, and it'll have segments of their letters. So I was trying to read a lot of primary source material just to see what kinds of language they were using and how they talked about things. And then, you know, little cheat things, like I subscribe to the OED online, the Oxford English Dictionary online, which is such a great resource, because if I stumbled on a word and I thought, I wonder if this is the right word that they would have used at that time, I could plug it in and look it up, and it would tell me exactly when that word was first used and how
great.
It was used. And so I was a little compulsive about this, actually. And one of the things that struck me, and I realized, both in terms of language and also in terms of, like, ideas, is that I was also struggling not just with how things really were, but also modern perception of how things were in the 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I would come across a word and I'd be like, wow, I can't believe they used it back then, but a reader's not going to think that's true. So I have to take that word out, even though it really was in use. Or, I mean, already I've encountered some people who have criticized the book and said, you know, Sophie has too feminist of views for her time. And in truth, there were women having much more radical progressive ideas at the time and writing about them and publishing about them. But you have to, as a writer, I'm struggling both with, you know, perception and true history and how it was at the time.
Right. And also, I don't know if this is applicable to your comment about feminism, but, you know, also just as far as language goes, 1885, as we've already said, was very different in Alaska than it was perhaps like in Europe, you know, so it could be that certain
right.
words did exist, but they aren't necessarily using them everywhere yet.
Well, and that's the other tricky thing, because then it was like by character, you know, there's a few sections that are written by a sergeant who's on the expedition in the diaries, and his, of course, he's much more illiterate and comes from a working-class background, so his language choice, and like I said, I really did not consider the challenges of all this when I thought, I'm going to write it all in letters and journals and documents. This will be really fun. And then as I got into it, I was like, and to be honest, a lot of times I had doubts, and I thought, man, I don't know, I'm not sure I can do this, you know, and then I would get a little encouragement from a reader or from some other, you know, somebody would say, no, this is interesting, and okay, I'll keep at it, but it was intimidating at times, to be honest.
Yeah. How long did it take you to write the book?
You know, it's funny because I've been trying to think about it because I've been asked that before. It's a little confusing because what happened is my agent signed on with The Snow Child and I finished it, and he was starting to test the market with it, but it was right around the recession and things were really crazy in publishing. So he said, let's like sit on this for 6 months or a year. And I was like, what? He's like, don't worry, just start working on the next book. So I actually started coming up with this idea and sort of developing it back then. But then eventually, of course, the Snow Child did sell, and I got very busy with travel and different things, so I put it aside, and then I picked it back up again after that. So I'm, you know, I think it was like two solid years of concentrated time, but the idea had been with me and sort of percolating along for quite a lot longer than that.
Okay. That sounds like your agent was really smart in what you did with the Snow Child. I'm sure that was so hard for you, but look at how well it did.
Yeah, it was excruciating, especially because it was my first novel, and I didn't even know, like, I didn't have that concept of publishing time. I was used to, like, newspaper journalism time,
yeah.
Which is the next day it's in print or it's not, you know, and you're on to the next thing. And it was very hard. But, no, I really trust my agent. And I hear people say, well, do you need an agent or not? And all I can say is, in my case, like, I couldn't have done it without him. He's really been a great advocate for me.
And who's your agent?
Jeff Kleinman. And he represents some other wonderful books, Art of Racing in the Rain.
Yeah,
he's got some really great authors, so I feel very fortunate that it worked out, that I ended up getting to work with him.
You're listening to Write the Book, and a new interview with the author Eowyn Ivey, who has just published To the Bright Edge of the World. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love it if you'd go to iTunes and rate it, or just pass along the show's information to some friends. Thanks, and keep listening. Let's talk about the character of the old Iyak Indian, and is that how you pronounce that?
I think it's Iyak, but yeah, it's pretty cool. Yep.
Okay, so there's this character who's, there are a number of Indians that go on the expedition as help, and one of them is this man who's old, and he's got a bum leg, and he's very mysterious. We first see him through Alan's eyes when Alan sees him up a spruce tree one night. He's very mysterious. He leaves people uneasy. At one point, Alan says, "I am left vaguely uneasy, as if I witnessed a bird flying underwater or a fish swimming across the sky." So I just wonder how you came to that character. We both don't trust him and also, in my case, enjoy him at certain points, but also kind of worry about him, what he's going to do. So talk about developing his character a little bit.
Yeah, well, he was really inspired by the raven, crow, trickster idea in a lot of Pacific Northwest and Alaskan storytelling. There's this sort of trickster person, raven, who can take a human form. And often, you know, and it was interesting for me to just try to kind of comprehend how this really works. Cause I think in a more, you know, Western civilization idea of a god, it's so different than this idea of a being who's going to maybe sometimes do a good favor for you or really make your life difficult and you don't know. And
right.
I just found that a really fascinating concept. And again, I was kind of going back to this whole idea of how we perceive the world, how do you understand what's happening to you, the things that seem unfair or really challenging or difficult, like why do those things happen? And I liked the idea of this person who could maybe like I say, bring you good favor or really wreak havoc on your trip
right.
or your life.
He could just choose.
Yeah, exactly. And you wouldn't know, you know, which I thought was kind of an interesting way to view life and what happens in sort of fate, I guess.
And I have a question a little bit later about racism and prejudice and how it might have affected an expedition like this, but I'm going to hold off on that one for just a little bit.
I
want to talk a little bit about Sophie. Now, you mentioned that she's a feminist, and I enjoyed her so much. I don't agree about her being too much of a feminist. I feel like human beings want to experience the world, and you give her a story that helps us understand that she's a curious person and she wants to experience the world fully, and she's being held back in various ways. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about her just generally before we get into more specific questions.
Sure. Well, I mean, I've had a few people ask, like, if there was a certain person in history or in my life who inspired Sophie. And in truth, really what it was, in part, at the very beginning, really what it was is I didn't want to write another Mabel. So Mabel's my main character in The Snow Child.
Right.
And I had a lot of compassion for her, and I wanted, in her story, to explore how someone who really struggles, basically with depression, comes to love a new place and accept a new way of life. But it was hard writing Mabel. And at times I was just like, oh, man, Mabel, are we going to get through this?
Right, because she's not only is she depressed, but she's isolated and it's dark and her husband's gone a lot of the time.
She is, and she has very good reasons to be depressed. But it was hard sometimes because, you know, when you're working on a novel, you're talking about spending 2-3 years with these characters.
Right.
And I thought, oh, I don't think I can do that. So I really wanted sort of a more spirited, lively, someone who kind of would always, plug on and find a way to deal with the situation she's given. So that was sort of the impetus as Sophie developed. But then as I started researching in history, I mean, there was just some really amazing naturalists, women who were doing, you know, photography and documenting of species and all these amazing things right at the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. So I kind of was inspired by a lot of those women.
Yeah, she's great. And to just expand on what I was saying about how you give an adequate background, in my opinion, for her feminism and her curiosity about the world, you have this wonderful section where her father has taken her out to see the bats. And do you mind if I read a little bit of that?
Oh, no, that'd be great.
She writes, "It was marvelous, the nights of anticipation, and then in the sky above me, the fleeting silhouettes of their wings. That is the excitement. We catch only glimpses, a burst of movement, a flap of wings, yet it is life itself beating at shadow's edge. It is the unfolding of potential. All of what we might experience and see and learn awaits us." And I thought giving her that background and that bond with her father was really important to her character and also to her love of nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's funny how, and I've talked to other writers about this a lot too, how oftentimes it takes getting partway through the novel for me to realize some of the backstory of who a person is, mm-hmm. and then I have to kind of go back and thread those through. So it's sort of like almost like I'm figuring out who the character is as I'm going along. So it took me a while to understand like her relationship with her father and how that all had kind of helped her become who she is, and with her mother as well. And then you have to kind of, and then I would have to go back and sort of weave that new thread through a little stronger, you know. And so it's you hope that it comes off as if like this is how Sophie always was, but it takes time and sort of like feeling around, trying different things and being like, oh, okay, this is how she got here. So.
Yeah, that felt very organic to me, that storyline. Now, meanwhile, Alan, her husband Alan, on his expedition is experiencing a different culture. And, you know, from just looking at women's roles, I loved this, the Native American women, "When a village moves, the women carry all the heavy loads," Alan writes. I was very intrigued at the way that you kept a thematic bond between Alan's and Sophie's experiences by constantly giving us a little bit of what each of them is experiencing in different places, but the themes stay linked even if they're in very different situations. Was that something that you were very conscious of as you wrote?
Yes and no. I mean, at times I would think like this is sort of resonating with something that's happening with Sophie, you know, that Alan's experiencing. But I'm also a little wary of making that too heavy-handed, you mm-hmm. know, and so I would try to back off a little bit at times. But it is, it's kind of a tricky thing because I wanted certain themes to be clear but not, like, beat you over the head, you know. So and back to the limitations of telling things in the first-person style is then you are limited to Alan as who he is, you know, a colonel in his 50s, a veteran of the Indians Wars, and somewhat of a stodgy guy, isn't going to notice the same things that Sophie would in those situations or, you know, perceive things the same way. So it's a challenge sometimes to let some of these things sort of trickle through or shine through, even when maybe Sophie would have been much more obvious about it if she had seen these things happening or whatever.
Right, right. Now, you talked about the Indian Wars, and that just reminds me, can you talk a little bit about filling in a reader on history they may not be familiar with?
Yeah, and that was tricky, too, because, of course, I had done so much research. Unlike The Snow Child, where I really didn't do that much research, this one, I mean, seriously, half my wall space in my library right now are all these research books that I now have no need for and I'm going to have to find a new home for, but because I was reading so much. And then the trick really become for me is to not just overload the reader with too much, you know, because I know way more about you know, some of the Indian War elements or photography in the 19th century than any normal reader would want to know.
Right.
So trying to just give just a hint so that the characters and the history feels three-dimensional, you hope, without sort of bombarding somebody with way more than they want to know. So it is, and it's hard. And to be honest, I feel a little bit like I'm just stealing the bits of history that I want or need. You know, I was just talking to a really great writer up here the other day who knows so much more than I do about, like, the Apache conflict and things. But I just was borrowing the parts that I felt like kind of explained some of who the colonel was.
Yeah. I remember interviewing Anita Diamond. Do you remember The Red Tent?
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember her saying when it came to how much of your research to include, she's like, you know, you read Moby Dick and you know so much more about rendering blubber than you ever wanted to know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe Melville can pull it off, but I don't think it would be a good idea if I went that direction.
Okay, so now both of your books that I have read have supernatural elements to them, and I wanted to talk about this. I wanted to, first of all, talk about your interest in the supernatural as an element in fiction, but also, you know, what are some of the pitfalls as a writer to avoid in writing evocative supernatural or magical stories without sort of succumbing to cliche or kind of like edging out of what you might want as a literary writer?
Yeah, it is tricky because, I mean, and the thing is that the line is in a different place for every reader.
Yeah.
You know, so for some people, my writing is too fantastical for them, and other readers would like more of that. You know, so I almost feel like, for me, I've just had to kind of trust my instinct and, you know, that saying about writing the book that you would want to read, that's kind of all I can do is write what I would, that I hope I would find interesting and would, you know, want to read as a reader, because everybody is so different about that. And I think for me, like, you know, with The Snow Child, it was really like something cracked open for me as a writer when I realized, because I had a completely different novel, and we might have talked about this before when we had our earlier conversation about The Snow Child, that I had a completely different novel that was, you know, 3/4 of the way done that I was just bored to death with.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, set in Alaska. It was sort of modern realism. And I just was not having fun with it as a writer. And I thought, if I'm not having fun, then a reader is not going to be having fun. And so realizing, you know, when I came across that little fairy tale, wait a minute, I can have magical, fantastical things happen. Like, it was really this sort of, you know, new realm of possibilities for me that made me excited as a writer. So really, it's very selfish. I do it because it's fun, you know, because I realize I can. And I, you know, I liked reading fantasy when I was a kid, but often I was disappointed with this idea that it was always happening on another world. You know, it wasn't happening in my backyard. And when I realized I could sort of merge these ideas, and I think there's a lot of that happening right now. I think a lot of writers are feeling more freedom to sort of merge genres and bring in elements from, you know, whether it's, you know, noir mysteries or whatever it is, and sort of swirled all together into their own blend. And I think it's kind of fun that way.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, we were just mentioning research a minute ago. I would love to know, without ruining it for your readers, I would love to know what's true. What is the true history that was the nugget that you started with?
So elements of the story are very based in reality. So there really was an expedition in 1885, and it was a lieutenant, Henry T. Allen, who led two other men up the Copper River, which is a pretty famous river in Alaska. Like, if you buy sockeye salmon at a restaurant, often it's Copper River sockeye salmon. So it's a very, you know, a famous and important river in Alaska. And he led this expedition up the Copper River, over the mountains, and then floated out on the Tanana on the Yukon. And it was the first time that section of Alaska, sort of the heart of Alaska, had been explored by white explorers. So that basic thing. And then there's other elements. I mean, he met a young chief named Chief Nikolai, who was a very important and famous chief in Alaskan history. And I just chose to fictionalize that, all of it, in terms of the characters and everything, just because that's how I felt more comfortable. Like, I didn't feel like I could try to tell the real Henry Allen story. And it's funny because you know, I was starting to put things up on my Facebook page, my author page, about the book coming out, and this man reached out to me and said, I'm the great-grandson of Henry Allen. And I live in Washington, D.C., and I'm excited about your book, which made me really, really excited, but also made me a little nervous. Like, I thought, I'm really glad I fictionalized it, because this is his real ancestor. I mean, he has a connection by blood to this person, and I don't think I have the right to tell his specific story of his internal monologue, how he was thinking and feeling. So those were some of the reasons I wanted to fictionalize all the characters, and even to some extent the place, so that I could just tell the story however I wanted to, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Now, hearing you talk about the expedition just reminds me of one thing I was going to tell you, which is when my dad was a young man, so probably in the 50s, he and his best friend rowed a canoe, I think, up the Yukon, and when they arrived, I wish I could remember the name of the city that they got to. It was like just a little outpost, but when they got there, they were told they were the first two white men who had ever done that.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, well, I also don't know if it's true. He could exaggerate sometimes, but it was...
Well, but that's one of the really wonderful things about Alaska, is there still are a lot of firsts to be done, you know, and so it really is a really... it's funny, because my daughters and I were just on a train tour, sort of a tourist train tour ride here in Alaska. It's a really beautiful ride, and the conductor, you know, the guide was saying that there are so many glaciers and mountains in Alaska that still haven't been named, and all it takes is someone climbing it, going there, and saying, I'm naming it this, you know, and that just seems so amazing to me that we still have that much unexplored and undiscovered territory. It's really kind of exciting, I think.
Yeah, although you want to be careful not to encourage too many people to try it without experience, or you're going to have another Into the Wild on your hands.
Exactly. And, well, and the guy did say you can have it named after you if you explore it, or if you die on that glacier mountain.
There you go.
And my daughter looked at me and said, I don't think I want a mountain named after me. I was like, yeah, I think maybe that's a good idea.
Yeah. Okay. What were your, when you did your research, we kind of talked about research, but I am curious, did you find any resources that you found very, very useful outside of the, I love to tell listeners about resources that aren't just Google.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tracked down books that were just amazing. James Carey is an anthropologist and linguist here in Alaska, and he had books where he had, I had moments of, you know, it kind of reminded me when I was in college. I remember when you're just reading a lot and learning a lot, all these connections start coming together, and I always loved that feeling as, you know, as a student. And it happened to me as I was working on this book. So, for example, I came across this translated dialogue where a woman was talking about her being a little girl when the real expedition, Lieutenant Allen, came into her village, and how they felt, how the children felt, how scared they were, and how strange it was, and they had never seen white people before. And it was just amazing to read that. And so that actually ended up inspiring a section in my book where that same kind of conversation happened.
Yeah.
And so and I do think that's one thing that I discovered how much I love about research. It can be a little daunting and overwhelming, but it can be so inspiring and take me into places that I really don't anticipate at all. And another case of that, too, is I interviewed a young man up here who largely inspired the character of Josh, the museum curator.
Oh, okay.
And he was so generous enough to really talk to me about his different feelings, about different elements of, you know, growing up with an indigenous background in Alaska. And it completely sort of blew away some of the preconceptions I had, and ended up changing how I told his story. So I think interviewing people, it's funny, as a newspaper reporter, I was super comfortable doing that. As a fiction writer, I haven't always been comfortable. I feel a little bit like an imposter, you know, like,
right.
Can I interview you for a novel I'm writing? But I think interviews can really be, it just expand your sense of, you know, we're limited to how we understand the world, how we grew up, and talking to someone who has a really different background, it could be really inspiring, I think.
Do you think as a journalist you felt like people have the right to know, and so I'm going to look into it and find out the truth and share that, whereas with fiction it's almost like we're stealing stories to use?
It does feel, and it also feels a lot too much like play or something, like I'm pretending and I'm having fun, so I feel a little weird asking for this like more formal kind of interview, you know? It does, and so yeah, I'm trying to be more comfortable about that and just be like, I'm a novelist, this is what I do, and I want to ask you questions. And people are always, I've never had anybody be annoyed or offended. People often want to tell you what they know about the world or how, you know, and same thing, I went down to Fort Vancouver and interviewed the archaeologist there at the fort and the historian, and they were so helpful and gave me so much information, and I was like, why was I afraid to do this, you know, because it really helped my story a lot, I think.
So didn't it help to be nominated for the Pulitzer Prize?
Well, you know,
I mean, don't you think you're a writer now?
You would think that I would get to some point where I would feel that way, but I still feel like it's not real in some way. And I think partly because it is fiction, like it is all pretend, and it does feel like too much fun to be paid for or to, you know, to bother other people with. And the truth is that as much as that was such a thrill for me to be a finalist for the Pulitzer, it really doesn't mean much to the vast majority of the world. Like, you know, lots of people have no idea who I am or who my books are. So it really is just someone saying, hey, I write novels, will you talk with me? You know, yeah. And it still feels a little bit like this is a lot to ask, you know?
Yeah, that's funny. Although you must have a certain name recognition at this point. First of all, you have an unusual name, and you live in a small place.
Well, that does help me. I have to thank my mom for doing that, because she gave me a good start there. And in Alaska, certainly. But Alaska is such a small, you know, we're such a close-knit community, you know, so I feel like the odds of people knowing me here, even if I hadn't written a book, were pretty high.
Yeah.
And now that I have, two books out, certainly here in Alaska, it happens, you know, I had to call 911 because there was a dangerous driver a couple of summers ago, so I was calling to report it in, and the woman asked for my name, and she said, are you the one who wrote this, No Child, you know? And I think that could only happen in Alaska. Like, we're just such a small community. But that's one thing I really love about it, because there's a lot of support here for the writers who live here.
Yeah. Now, are you of Native American ancestry?
No, I'm not.
Okay,
no,
so is Aowin's not a Native American name?
No, it's actually from The Lord of the Rings.
Oh.
So when I was a kid, people would ask me, like, is it Welsh? Is it Irish? Is it Celtic? And I would just agree to whatever they said. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And then once the movies came out, now actually a lot of younger people will be like, wait a minute, isn't that from the Lord of the Rings movie? So, yeah, my mom named me after a character in the book.
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, we probably talked about that the first time, but I didn't remember that. That's great. But I wanted to talk about the Native Americans in the book. It's a big theme, the treatment of not just Native Americans, prejudice in general and respect and how people treat each other is a theme in the book. On the expedition, there are moments where the Indians are just treated badly by individual people, not necessarily by every person. And then back with Sophie, where she is having her own experience waiting for Alan to come home, she witnesses the prejudice against servants who are of Irish or Chinese heritage, and their treatment is very uncomfortable. And I loved this line. At one point she says, "Why do I find it impossible to speak my mind in these moments, in these instances? I worry too much about offending or rousing conflict." That was so human of her to ask that of herself. And I think we all feel a little bit that when we're in a situation where we could speak up and we don't. Can you just talk about giving her those feelings?
Yeah, and again, you know, a lot of it, as I was doing research, I was just really impressed in history, the Quakers, how progressive they were, and so often, you know, fighting to end slavery and fighting for women's rights. So some of what I was, you know, sort of attributing to her were a lot of the beliefs and understanding of the time for the Quaker movement. But personally, this is something I have struggled with in situations. I tend to be a fairly, like, amicable kind of person in conversations. I sort of want to just, like, laugh and have everyone have a good time. So I have found myself at times where someone says something offensive that I just hesitate and I don't speak up my mind, and I have regretted that many times. And
right.
So partly I was sort of, you know, projecting onto her some of my own struggles with that. But I am really glad, you know, again, that with the limitations of first person, to sort of allow some of the prejudice and things happening on the Allen expedition to come through, even though the men don't see it themselves, it was a challenge, and I was hoping, I feel like it takes a closer reading, and I'm really glad that you are that kind of close reader to pick up on some of that stuff, because I think that some people miss that, and I tried to put in these little things that show that although the Colonel in ways is a good man and tries his best, he has his weaknesses and prejudices, and they do affect his decisions and how he treats people.
Right. Well, I have a couple of instances here that I think point out the difference. So there's one character who's kind of horrible, and an anecdote is relayed that he once yanked an Indian child from his mother's hands in trade for furs the father didn't bring in. So there's that example. But then from Alan's own words, just sort of recounting the day's events, he says, "We left the Indians and sleds to retrieve them later." And I was like, what?
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean.
And I had that experience actually reading the Real Expedition reports, where I was struck by Henry Allen, the Real Lieutenant, in ways was fairly progressive for his time. I was sort of impressed that, you know, some of the ideas he expressed were relatively modern, but then some little thing would come through and you think, no, he is a product of his time.
Yeah.
Like, there are just things that they can't see past. And so I did try to, and like I say, I'm just really glad. I do think it takes a little bit of a closer reading, and I'm glad you picked up on that.
Oh, and I should say thank you for calling me a close reader.
No, it's something that I've learned more and more as a writer. I mean, I know that the vast majority of responsibility is on me as the writer to communicate things clearly. But as I read, and I know I should do this, I read all my Amazon reviews and Goodreads reviews. I can't help myself for some reason. And in some cases, I'll think, oh, this person has a really valid criticism, and how could I address that differently as a writer? But other times, I admit, sometimes I think, no, they didn't read it. They missed something that was there, and maybe I should have made it a little more obvious, but maybe they just weren't reading it close enough. So I realize it's sort of this dialogue between a reader and a writer that I didn't quite grasp, I think, with my first novel. It didn't quite click with me, that understanding.
Yeah, and I think you have to keep in mind, too, that there are Amazon readers who will rate a book with 1 star because they say, I thought this was going to be about basketball, you know, so, I mean, it's
there
really...
There is that, and there is the struggle, I realize, once you have a novel out, you have laid expectations. So either people didn't like your first novel, and so they're set to not like your second novel,
right.
Or they really liked your first novel, and then the new novel isn't the same. You know, so it's sort of a mixed blessing to be on a sophomore book. I think it's a little trickier.
Absolutely, and particularly if your first book went really well commercially, and
I do feel nervous.
So the other side of this that I think is related to the idea of prejudice is the respect that the Native Americans show to their natural world. And that doesn't mean that they don't kill animals to eat them, but there's this one point where the expedition has been able to slaughter a caribou to eat. And then the Indians skinned their animal and tossed bits of meat to their open beaks. Tillman asked why they threw scraps to the birds. And then this character named Samuelson answers that they are saying their thanks because the birds led them to the herd of caribou. And I just thought this was a nice juxtaposition because we have just barely seen an example of how the Indians are treated poorly. And the Indians treat their natural world as just so vital and important and with respect, really.
Right. Yeah, and that was something that really I found really interesting, and I was trying to, explore in different ways in terms of which stories I chose that have fantastical elements. I wanted to kind of explore this idea that I think for people who live very much closer to the land, you know, by necessity to some extent, the Native Americans that were living, especially in that part of Alaska at the time, were very much struggling just to eke out a living from year to year. Their sense of importance of things like birds and the animals and the fish, I mean, it's like it's a much more immediate cause and effect relationship mm-hmm. between them and the natural world. And so then I think that line between what makes a human and what makes an animal, I think is my sense in reading the stories I was reading in the research, it's just not as black and white as I think the kind of more Western civilization idea of like dominion and we can conquer this. I think the Native Alaskans had a much better appreciation for just how much stronger the natural world is than them.
Right. Well, and I know that this isn't what you're referring to, but also just that is what allows for their shape-shifting mythology or legend or in your book, truth, which is so great. So we went fast. I have all these questions I'm not going to get to, but I do have one last question for you before we finish up. And that is, ultimately, this book is a love story. It's a lot of things, but at the heart of To the Bright Edge of the World is a love story. And I wondered if we could finish up with your offering some advice to listeners who might be trying to write a love story. And I think that there are elements to that are similar to what we already talked about with the supernatural, where you kind of have to avoid certain pitfalls to do it well. So do you have any advice along those lines?
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah, it is. I do find it something that I didn't want to be heavy-handed with or trite or cliche. And I guess in my case, I mean, for one thing, I did look to other, The Cold Mountain was a huge inspiration for me because I think it tells a love story so well in terms of two fully realized humans, you know, with their own individual struggles, just working so hard to be back with each other. And that sort of inspired me in a lot of ways. And, of course, there's a lot of classic, you know, the Odyssey, all these stories that are of that thread. But I guess for me, I felt like the best thing that I could do is to allow them to be as fully realized as characters as I could imagine. And then that way their love and their fear, all those emotions would hopefully ring true if they seemed like true people. So I guess that was the only guidance I really had, and looking to, you know, other books that really inspired me.
Okay, that's great. I want to just mention again, the book is To the Bright Edge of the World by Eowyn Ivey. It's published by Little Brown, and I really appreciate you talking with me today. It was really fun.
Oh, thank you so much. Wonderful questions. I really enjoyed it.
That, again, was a conversation with Eowyn Ivey. If you'd like to read more about her work, her website is at eowynivey.com. I also spoke with Eowyn back in 2012 about her novel, The Snow Child. You can find that interview on Write the Books podcast site. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Eowyn Ivey, who finds old photographs interesting and inspiring as she writes her novels. She says looking into the eyes and faces of people from the past offers new perspective and motivation in her work. One resource is the Alaska Historical Photograph Archive at vilda.alaska.edu. I will include a link on the podcast site. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest for Write the Book or comments about the show, news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. As soon as we are broadcasting on the new radio station WBTV, I'll be announcing book-related events again. For now, we're just podcasting. As I said earlier, if you like the show, please rate it on iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. Have a great week.